Joining us on Front and Center now is State Senator Paul Formica, Republican from the 20th District. And for those who do not know, the 20th District includes Basra, East Lyme, a portion of Montville and New London, Old Lyme, a portion of Old Saybrook, Salem, and Waterford. And Senator Formica, welcome to Front and Center.
Thank you so much.
It is a great time of year to be from that particular district, isn't it, along the shore?
Hey, we live in the best district in Connecticut. It's beautiful down here in southeastern Connecticut. We're at the height of our tourism season, and you know, there's just so many things to do here. You're right. It's absolutely the best place to be this time of year.
How about the wintertime? You get much snow that area of the state?
You know, we do. It gets mitigated a little bit by the salt air. But, you know, we've had some, you know, some big snow winters over the last four or five. So we get our share of it.
One of the reasons we have Senator Formica on the program today is because there's a new report out, a new survey by Wallet Hub, which ranks states with the highest property taxes, and Connecticut comes in number six out of the 50 states, just behind New Jersey, Illinois, New Hampshire, Wisconsin, and Texas. What's your reaction to that?
Well, you know, I think it's just part of the overall climate that we find ourselves in. We seem to be near the top in all of those categories we should be near the bottom at. We're near the bottom at all of those things we should be near the top at. So, you know, it's not surprising. It's also a very expensive place to live here in the Northeast, which, you know, is a bit of a factor if you're a mayor or first selectman of a small town. But, you know, it's a difficult environment that the state is facing right now.
Well, as some people might know, you used to be the first selectman of East Lyme. What do you hear from your constituents now as a state senator, even though it doesn't fall directly under your domain? What do you hear about property taxes?
Well, you know, we hear that every tax is becoming more and more difficult to bear for the people in the state of Connecticut, businesses and residents alike. You know, now they're talking about some kind of mileage tax that they're going to spend $300,000 on some study to determine whether they want to replace the gas tax with a mileage tax. So, you know, we need to get out of the business of taxing as much as we can and get into the business of being partners with cities and towns to help their property tax burden, and working to promote, you know, the business environment so we can get some people in here that are going to create some jobs and generate some revenue for our state.
You know, I would go so far as to say that even this survey is somewhat misleading, because they place Connecticut sixth with an average property tax of $3,301. And that's an average. I mean, if you live in a modest home, let's say an 1,100 square foot home, I know a lot of people, you can count me among them, whose property taxes are over $5,000 a year, Senator.
Yeah, I think I'm in that list too. So, you know, it's a very difficult environment. But, you know, that's where the state needs to be partners with cities and towns, because it's the city and town budget that generates most of the property tax. The state doesn't really collect property tax, but it's the trickle-down effect that we have when the state is obligated to fund certain portions of revenue to cities and towns, and then they back out of it, and it forces a knee-jerk reaction on the community, who have already set their budgets in many cases by the time the state gets there, and it forces these difficulties that occur.
Which was the case this year, right? These municipalities had their budgets set, and because of the state's budget problems, some municipal aid was reduced, right?
Well, the municipal aid, and specifically education cost sharing. I mean, the budget that the state put out this year was basically a big shift onto other entities. It was a shift onto cities and towns. It was a shift onto education. It was a shift onto hospitals and health care. It was a shift onto business, and a shift away from the responsibilities of the state. But, for example, the education cost sharing for the town of Waterford, they were expected to get $1.4 million. And that, you know, it's not a lot of money in the scheme of things when you have a $60 million budget for the town of Waterford. But $1 million is $1 million. And probably near a half a mil. And so they just cut that without warning because they didn't have the money to fund it. And, you know, for my money, if we're going to be making those kind of cuts to hospitals and cities and towns, we need to do it with a plan. If we had said to whatever, hey, then we're going to have some trouble. We're going to cut you $300,000 a year for 3 years. Get used to it. So cities and towns will react. But that's what I mean about being partners with the communities. And now, you know, Waterford has $1 million cut in ECS and $1 million cut in their Friendship Magnet School that they're going to have to try to make up. And how do you do that?
Again, having sat in that first selectman seat, how much do the unfunded mandates by the state affect these municipal budgets?
Well, you know, again, going back to education, when the state decided to force the evaluation of all teachers on, you know, onto a new program of evaluation for teachers on the city of town, I think in East Lyme, that along with an additional, you know, $350,000 that would have cost to measure those evaluations, to manage those evaluations, and to replace people at work while they were doing those evaluations.
Is there ever a conversation, Senator, about reducing these unfunded mandates on the municipalities?
Well, there's a whole laundry list of things, and they started what they call the Moore Commission, which is a municipal opportunity for regional efficiency, and they invited mayors and first selectmen to participate in all of these things, and you know they have discussions on it. And then they claim that there's regional efficiency, so they cut $20 million in the budget this year based on the work of the Moore Commission, yet if you look in the details, there's no real evidence of any regional efficiencies that saved the town $20 million. So it was just another opportunity to cut. But that's one of the things we have to do, and we need mayors and first selectmen at the table to sit down and talk about how we work together, just as we need business. You know, we have large businesses leaving the state, and we need to have a better communication with them so we can find out how we can work together so everybody wins.
You own a business. How do the property taxes affect your business?
Well, we pay a lot of property tax for the location that we're on, and we also pay a significant property tax for all the equipment that we have. So, you know, we're not a manufacturer, so that there's no credit for that. So, you know, we pay property taxes based on that, and it's a big number that goes to the town, and we're just about to hit an evaluation where they're going to, you know, reevaluate what's happening in the community based on the values of the properties and businesses, and that'll be another tax increase, I'm sure.
Because of property taxes on equipment, is that a disincentive to go out and buy new equipment for you?
You know, in my business, the way I run my business, we want to make sure that we have the best equipment so that we can provide the best service. So, you know, I'll go out there and do that. But you know what? You have to really count and make sure that, you know, the equipment that you take offline gets taken offline at the town hall. And sometimes you miss a violator or a stove or, a dozen tables or chairs that, you know, so it's difficult in that it creates more work for you to manage those types of things. Larger businesses, I would imagine it would. Manufacturers and, businesses that create, 500,000 pieces of equipment, doctor's offices that have, image machines that are $1 million. I mean, that's difficult.
Talking with State Senator Paul Formica from the 20th Senatorial District along the shore in Connecticut. And for people who do not know, the senator's business is Correct me if I'm wrong on this, Flanders Fish Market and Restaurant, is that correct?
Yes, it is. We just celebrated our 33rd year in business this year, and we're inducted into the Connecticut Hospitality Hall of Fame by the Connecticut Restaurant Association. So we've had a wonderful opportunity and a lot of support from the community in East Line.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. A lot of hard work by a lot of great staff.
Well, you know, and I've interviewed restaurant owners on this program before, and I don't think people realize, those who might even have a dream of someday owning a store/market restaurant, that it's really a 24/7 commitment, 7 days a week, right?
Well, I think any small business is, you bring your passion to bear, and you want to make sure you share it with the customers. And, you know, my dad used to say, if you want a successful business, you find somebody's headache and you become their aspirin. And dealing with problems all the time and trying to keep a business up and running is 24/7. I'm fortunate. I have two of my four children are in the day-to-day management of the business now. And, it's a little bit helpful to have them there. And I've had a great staff who've been there a long time. But, there's no businesses anymore, I don't think.
This conversation while we have you on, Senator, about raising the minimum wage, we always hear it, raise the minimum wage. Does that affect a business like yours?
Oh, sure. It affects the municipality we're in. For example, park and recreation departments along the shoreline hire a lot of seasonal summer help, landscaping, lifeguards, ticket takers. All of that would be raised. I think when I was first selectman, we figured it'd be about $35,000 or $40,000 just in that department. So that increases the property tax burden. And in my business, the minimum wage, we pay mostly above minimum wage anyway, but it is the bar on everybody else, because instead of a trickle down, it's a trickle up. If you give somebody a dollar or $2 or $5 an hour raise to meet minimum wage, those people that are making above that, want to be compensated the same way. So it has a rising effect on payroll.
So essentially what you're saying is, Senator, the hike in the minimum wage, it does have an effect.
It has a big effect. And in Seattle, it's actually caused a reduction in jobs, which would offset the perceived tax increase that a higher minimum wage is going to be. But one of the things we have to think about is people do need a living wage. And we need to have a split minimum wage, if you ask me. A head of household should make more money than a bus person at a restaurant. Bus people in restaurants have to be paid minimum wage, even if they are given tips by waitresses that they support, because they don't get direct tips from the customer. So it doesn't make sense for a 16 or 17-year-old kid to be getting $10 or $15 an hour and then getting $50 or $60 in tips a night. So, I think we should look at a head of household minimum wage, people that are leading their own household, heads of families, that have those expenses versus younger kids. And, maybe there's a way to ease into something like that over a period of time. But
is there even a hint of conversation about that kind of a concept?
Well, I brought it up at the last session. I'll bring it up again this session, but it wasn't, it wasn't included in any of the bill. The bill that came forward before the Senate talked about a $12 an hour minimum wage. As you know, in January, I believe we go up to $10.10. I pay, for example, in my business, more than that now. So that particular one wouldn't affect me, but there's a lot of people it does affect. And they're talking about paid family leave and, all kinds of things, when we should be talking about stabilizing the state's finances, looking at ways to save money and create effective efficiencies within our agencies so that we can reduce the burden on the residents and businesses and get people back in here and back to work.
It's interesting because the legislature, and this is the majority party I'm talking about now, doesn't seem to have the appetite to tackle that issue. And so we have a budget crisis year after year, Senator.
And you know, we had $900 million in deficit reduction that we had to handle in last fiscal year ending on June 30th. We had another $900 million that we had to handle for this fiscal year beginning July 1st, and we're going to have probably an equal amount of that for next year. And it's because we're not anticipating our revenues correctly. They're falling off the charts, and unfortunately, we're spending up to a revenue expectation that we don't achieve. So it's time to really look at different ways to govern, and that is a combination of agencies and being proactive and not reactive.
You know, because you're in an area where tourism is big and the tourism budget was cut, how has that affected tourism down in your neck of the woods?
Well, you know, I don't know that the tourism money has affected it quite yet, but it certainly will. There's a lot of money. The three Eastern, Western, and Central tourism districts were defunded completely. A lot of agencies were given cuts, but these were defunded completely. And so I chair the Tourism Caucus, which we started, which is a group of bipartisan legislators to come together to talk things tourism. And we're trying to work our way through that, working with the DECD and Secretary Barnes of OPM to see what we come up with in terms of a new model. But it's definitely going to affect things. And I like to say in my business, you know, I don't advertise in July and August because I don't need the business as much. We advertise when things are down, and Connecticut needs tourism, and we should be out there advertising and spending those dollars because it generates a 3 or 4 to 1 revenue return for the state. So it's a tough time to be talking about cutting advertising dollars for the state.
Before we wrap up our interview, I want to get back to the property tax for just a moment, because there are some people who believe the concept of a property tax is outdated. There should be another way to underwrite the budgets of these municipalities, and perhaps it should fall under the umbrella of the state. What do you say about all of this?
Well, I think that we need an entire tax restructure from the federal government all the way down to the city and town level. So I agree with that concept. How do we get there is the $64 question. So cities and towns' biggest property tax impact is created by education. The state has an obligation to fund education that they don't currently meet, and they need less and less of that obligation each year. So the first step is to get cities and towns together with state education officials and determine how we can best benefit education and who pays for special education and how is that compensated and how are those education dollars funding? Because in many communities, the cost of educating children represents 70% to 80% of the property tax burden. So if we can get a handle on that, reduce that by 10% or 15%, then we're going to find that we're on our way to a solution. So I think that's job one.
Not to mention, by the way, when you talk about the education budget, some of the cost of the education budget is driven by the special education aspect of the budget, right?
Special education is a very complicated reimbursement for cities and towns. There's big transportation issues when you can't manage someone with the deep special opportunities and you have to transport them to other communities. There's a lot of difficulties with regard to funding special education. One of the things this year that was cut out of the budget was the transportation reimbursement from the state to cities and towns. So it's, I think there's a 4 to 1 multiplier before the cities and towns can begin to recoup some of their education dollars. So when you're talking about a $12,000 to $15,000 cost per student, it gets very expensive.
Well, Senator, this conversation has been very illuminating. Our guest today has been Senator Paul Formica from the 20th Senatorial District in the state of Connecticut. And, Senator, I thank you very much for being a guest on Front and Center.
Well, I thank you for the opportunity to visit with you and look forward to coming back again.